loading in 3, 2, 1. Welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. It's the cure for the common restaurant. Expert interviews, tools, and tips to get you the restaurant you know it can be. Now, here is your host, Donald Burns, the Restaurant Coach.
Welcome to the Restaurant Coach Podcast. It is the cure for the common restaurant. This is, I have to say, lucky episode number 13.0, and I am honored to have as my guest a friend and fellow foodable TV industry expert and culinary professional, Chef Jim Berman, on the show. This interview was taken from our Facebook Live interview series. Jim is he is a true professional, and his passion for the culinary arts really comes through with his wit, humor, and insight into what it means to be a chef today. Lots of information in this episode, so sit back and enjoy. And hello, Facebook. Welcome to another RCU live event sponsored, of course, by the Restaurant Coach University, the premier online learning platform for restaurants that want to maximize their potential. Tonight, we're going to talk about a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that is being a chef in today's market. Now, there's a lot of changes going on in the restaurant industry, especially in the culinary arts. And to help me kind of understand some of the changes going on and help you also, and to make adjustments, I am honored to welcome a fellow foodable TV industry expert, Chef Jim Berman, to the show. Hello, Jim. How are you tonight?
I am absolutely fabulous. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. Hey, so for people who maybe just tuning in tonight, you know, first time on the show, maybe not know your story, you know, your epic legend as it is, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and your background? How's that?
Absolutely. Epic in my own mind, for sure.
Exactly, huh?
Well, you know, it goes back, you know, I kind of have the classic storied background. I think most cooks do. You know, 15 years old, went up to Canada during high school to from Pittsburgh to be a server at a fishing club. They needed a help in the kitchen on the second day, so I was basically the assistant cook, which basically meant I filled soup cups.
That's it. You know, we call that garbage one, right?
point one. When, you know, finished up the summer, went back, you know, finished up high school and whatnot. And then during my college career, I found that, you know, kind of lying to get cooking jobs, you know, do you have grill experience? Oh, sure. Because I used to grill steaks like on my mother's grill. So, of course, I had grill experience. You know, it was a really easy way to get a job. And, you know, I was going to, I went to Syracuse and I went to the University of Pittsburgh and going to school for investment banking because my dad said I was going to be an investment banker. So I was going to be an investment banker. And while I was working at in Pittsburgh, going to Pitt, I was working in some pretty nice restaurants. I worked in what happened to be the Esquire Magazine Restaurant of the Year, and kind of started to get serious about it. Went through a pretty nasty blizzard in Pittsburgh and realized, you know what, I want to move. I'm sick of the snow. Crossed off a bunch of places on a map, and the last one was Santa Fe, New Mexico. And
I know
Santa Fe, still kind of thinking I was going to be an investment banker, but got to Santa Fe and realized, you know, I kind of like what I'm doing. And man, that's really where the bug bit me. Did my ACF chef's apprenticeship work at the Community College of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Spent some time out there, got sick of that, had visited a friend in Delaware a bunch of times, and made my way back to the East Coast to Delaware. Been here since 94, and really, really classic story of, you know, line cook, lead line cook, you know, supervisor, work in business and industry, accounts, corporate dining, independent restaurants, helped open a couple places, made my way up to, you know, exec chef, you know, at the age of, I don't know, 27 or something like that. Started teaching when I turned 30, teaching culinary arts, did my professional development at New England Culinary Institute, and left teaching, went work with a regional restaurant group. They were opening and developing some properties, did some work with them, and then most recently did the jump into kind of the corporate world, and been worked with a food service company for a couple of years now while I'm pursuing my very fledgling writing career that started in 1999, but for some reason still seems to be fledgling, but that's okay. But really just kind of a textbook story of, you know, more responsibilities, you know, a little bit more pay, more responsibilities, more pay. And, you know, that kind of, you know, I think that's how it happens for most cooks.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. So where did you work in Santa Fe?
I was at right in the middle of the desert at one of the best Italian restaurants around. I was at Julian's Italian Bistro, this little tiny place right in the heart of Santa Fe, working for, at the time, a tyrannical chef, which to this day still holds a great place in my heart. I'm sure he doesn't know it, and at the time I certainly didn't know it, but he was just a wicked, fierce guy. I hate using the P word because everybody uses it, but he talk about passionate, you know, the guy like lived and breathed it. And I really learned a lot. You know, there was many a day I went home with a scowl on my face, but, you know, really taught me, you know, he taught me a lot. I also worked at Harry's Roadhouse, which is still there.
Oh yeah. That's one of my favorite places to go for brunch.
Absolutely. That was one of those places where they've really come a long way. I've kind of watched them from afar. They, you know, when I was there, the kitchen, I think, was maybe like 6x6 square on a Sunday morning. We cranked out, you know, I don't know, 150, 200 covers, maybe. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was a long time ago. But, again, another place with a lot of food heart, and I really liked that a lot. Yeah, yeah.
I think the kitchen's still the same size, and the patio is huge, you know.
I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that. The food was really good. I liked, you know, when I was there, Money Magazine, I don't even know if Money Magazine is still around, had named them like one of the best values in New Mexico. So that like overnight, you know, we added a zero to our covers.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, a little PR goes a long way, especially in New Mexico. Man, yeah. You get written up in New Mexico, especially in a national magazine in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Boom. You know, you just might as well just, you know, just plan on doubling your covers easily.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
So let me get it straight. You left. And people ask me all the time, why did you move to New Mexico? You know, because I've lived all over. I lived in, you know, LA, I lived in Chicago, I lived in Boston, and I finally moved back to New Mexico. And I go, why did you move to New Mexico? And I always say, I'm going to tell you just this, 310 days of sunshine average a year.
Yeah.
And you left that to go back to Delaware.
I did. I like the change of seasons. I like the cold. I don't know.
Hey, you get snow in Santa Fe.
It did. And, you know, it was funny because it would snow like crazy all night. And then by like noon the next day, it was like 7 o'clock. Like, yeah. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, that's because, you know, we don't have any snow equipment here because of that. You know, 1 inch of snow on the highway, shut the highway down. That's it. That's it. We don't have any equipment for this. That's it. We got an inch of snow. That's it. Shut I-25 down. No one's going anywhere.
You know, that's exactly right.
Canceled. I mean, there's the only place in the world I know where, like, an inch of snow, that's it. Stores are closed. School's canceled. We can't do this. We don't have equipment for this. It's crazy.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And it might have something to do with, you know, you go for a walk late at night, and there are, like, rattlesnakes and scorpions and black widow spiders all within, like, the first quarter mile of a walk. So that might have had something to do with it, too.
That is true. That is true. All right, so let's dig into some stuff. Let's get some people here listening tonight. You give them some real solutions. So, you know, we all know, working in this business, there's always kind of this big divide between, you know, front of the house and the back of the house.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of your solutions? How can a modern culinary professional repair this kind of, you know, internal divide?
Burn the restaurant down?
Yeah, really?
Okay. I think that the battle between front of the house and back of the house is, man, that's as old as time. And I think that a lot of times back of the house kind of precipitated that. You know, there was a lot of times where, you know, you had a screaming chef that it was, you know, my way or the highway. And, right. You know, with the changing face of our industry, that mm-hmm. doesn't really work anymore. And I've talked to a lot of folks, you know, in writing articles and in traveling. You know, I had a great opportunity to work with Jenna Gurmeta up in New York a couple months ago. And I actually asked him how, you know, he's a very, very soft-spoken, you know, celebrity chef, very kind of laid back. And, you know, one of his things was, you know, just mutual respect. You know, there's no screaming, there's no yelling, right. Kind of that. And I hate to say that the era of the screaming chef is gone, because I like to scream at people once in a while, and it's kind of fun, because sometimes it's a good catalyst for getting something done. You know, he mentioned the whole respect thing where, you know, maybe inviting front of the house staff into the back of the house to do some task work, whether it's picking some herbs, maybe it's sending back of the house people because we have all this extra time out front to roll silverware. You know, that kind of goes a long way to build mutual respect. One of the pieces that I really like is family meal. You know, don't call it staff meal because staff meal is kind of like that 50% discount thing or whatever. Right, yeah. I do want a family meal, an honest to goodness family meal. Had a really, really fortunate experience of sitting for family meal at Gramercy Tavern in New York City. And it was about one of the most heartwarming experiences I've ever had, you know, where you have a cultural hodgepodge of folks that take great pride in the food that they prepare at home and to be able to prepare it for each other and then sit down like humans, you know, not, you know, we've all done the milk crate sitting out by the dumpster, you know, apron thrown over your shoulder, cigarette in one hand and, you know, a cup of, you know, ice cold coffee in the other while you're having your family meal. But to actually have an honest to goodness family meal where it's that deep breath, it's that relaxing sigh, it's that Zen moment, you know, right before, you know, the printer starts to vomit, you know, dupes onto the expo line. You know, I think family meal is a great opportunity for front of the house and back of the house to really just kind of come together and do their thing. I also think leading by example, you know, if you're screaming at a server because they rang in something wrong, or you've got a front of the house manager barking at a cook because, you know, something went on undercooked or overcooked, you know, you lead by example, you set the culture, you set the climate, and you hold everybody accountable for those results. I think that is just critical. I don't care if it's on a large scale, like our own political environment right now, or on a small scale, like in a school from the role of a principal, or in a business, in an office, whoever your leadership is, that leadership style trickles down and you lead by example. And what you do very much dictates to the people around you what the expectation is on how they behave. So, you know, can you fill that chasm between front of the house, back of the house? There's a little tiny part of me that says no, because let's not do that because it's kind of fun to abuse that to somebody else. But, you know, the practical side of it is our labor market is so tough that people will quit for really no reason. So if you give them a reason, they're definitely going to bounce. Mm-hmm. But if you can make it just that much more of a hospitable environment, go for it. Your turnover rate's going to be less. If somebody doesn't go home at the end of the night, you know, mad, or you know, goes home and kicks the cat, then that's a good thing. That's a good day. So it's a battle as old as, you know, Isaac and Ishmael, unfortunately, but we're going to, you know, keep mustering through. And, you know, there's a couple solutions that you can offer. You know, there's a couple pieces.
Yeah. One of the biggest things I tell all my clients is that it's not, you know, and it's always, like you said, it's always a classic divide, front house, back house, day staff versus night staff. Yeah. You know, I would say good versus evil, classic antagonists, you know, but here's the thing. We don't have to pay, we have to play into it if we don't want to. And here's my thing. If you work in a restaurant, it's one team, you know, working together. Cause here's the thing, your competition is the one you really should be worried about. It's the people out there trying to take market share from you. Yeah. And there's a great African proverb. If there's no enemy within, enemy outside can do us no harm. And so I always tell people all the time, it's like, stop having these internal struggles, these internal battles, because the real enemy is not, you know, front of house, back of house, day staff, night staff, you know, it's none of that, you know, owners versus everybody else, you know, it's not that, you know, it's us against everyone out there who's trying to take our market share and basically, you know, take our covers and take our money. So,
Yeah, absolutely agree. And, you know, and I think, you know, just to add to your point, I think one of the pieces that people forget about, you know, people in the back of the house are often there for careers.
Yes.
And not to diminish what the people in the front of the house do at all. But sometimes the people in the front of the house aren't there for their careers. This is a stopping over point. And I think we need to understand that. And you don't necessarily hold the front and the back to the same standard. You set standards, but it's not necessarily the same.
Right.
I know from a cook being in the back of the house freaking out because a server did something wrong, they really don't have as much invested as I do.
Right.
Once I understand that and can appreciate that, I can speak in a different language that maybe can get them moving forward. And just like you said, you know, let's not fight. Let's move it forward. So yeah, I agree.
It goes back to that mutual respect. Mutual respect is everything, you know?
It is. And it's hard. That's a hard, you know, respect is a tough piece to teach.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, let's talk about that real quick. So one of the things I do is, like, everyone has their own different kind of definition of what respect is. And if we don't talk about it, it's like core values. If we don't get it on the table and talk about, you know, so, you know, chef, what's respect to you? And then I've been talking to the service team, you know, what's respect to you? And we can see a lot of times we have a kind of sometimes a gap between the two. And if we don't close the gap with open, honest conversations, we're always going to have those things. Well, they just don't get it. They don't care like I do.
Sure.
Not that they don't care. They maybe just have a different version and definition of some of the words that we use that are common that we kind of take for granted or assume that people understand. So,
agreed.
Yeah.
Agreed.
All right. So let's go to that dark area. All right.
Bring it.
We all know chefs have egos, you know, and some have that kind of ego that makes reality TV what it is. And, you know, how can chefs really balance out confidence versus cockiness?
You know, it's I think what we see on TV is both a blessing and a curse for our business. I really do. I think that whether you love it or hate it, there's definitely a notoriety, if you will. There's definitely a public presence for what happens in the back of the house with cooks and chefs. You know, if you think that everybody is Gordon Ramsay, you're wrong. You know, if you think everybody is Alton Brown and this kind of kitchen geek, you're wrong. I think that the whole kitchen ego piece was definitely birthed by what we see on TV. And I think that can be a little scary because you've got a lot of people that go into this business and expect one thing, and reality is very different. We all know that the study of blank very rarely mirrors the actuality of blank, you know, whether it's studying law and practicing law or studying cooking and practicing cooking. Those are very different things. I always tell, you know, I do a lot with food safety, and I always tell the participants in food safety classes, you know, in training sessions that this is like driver's ed. You know, driver's ed, you know, you had that cute little book and you read it, but then the actuality is, let's go out on the road. Let's not like run over somebody, and we're like halfway home to success. I think the same can be said for, you know, what we're seeing with people watching TV and building up kind of that chef ego thing. Now, that being said, we got a lot of cooks. We got a lot of chefs that, you know, hey, I'm a superhero. My apron is just a cape turned around, and I've seen that a couple times. I don't know where that came from. that's crap.
Come on. Every chef has put an apron on like a cape. Come on. You know it.
Yes, I did when I was like four, or I was brand new and I thought the world was going to stop because I made like the best souffle. Well, you know what? Somebody else makes a better souffle. And once you get past that, okay, let's talk camaraderie. You know, I think ego is one thing, and we all like to have big egos. But you know what? There are really important tow truck drivers. There are really important accountants. There are really important, you know, whatever. There are really important cooks out there doing some really great stuff. That said, I want to network with those guys. I want to talk. I want to throw my arm around somebody and go, hey, buddy, man, that was a great dish that you just put out. Maybe tell me a little bit about it or whatever. I think camaraderie goes a lot further than kind of that swaggery, you know, look at my cape thing.
Right.
You know, I'm here in Delaware. This coming weekend, we have an event for Benefits the March of Dimes.
Oh, nice.
It's a chef invitational. It's a celebrity. They call it a celebrity chef brunch. You know, the celebrity is whatever. But these are a bunch of chefs coming from all over the country, plus Canada, you know, which, okay, we'll call that some bonding with our friends to the north. but, you know, these guys, they get together, and I've actually been part of it, you know, in the past. And these guys get together, and it's like old family. You know, they get together, they talk food, they compliment each other's dishes, they offer insight without being jerks about it. I think that really goes a long way. I'm a big fan of the TV show that's now debunked, The West Wing. And one of the episodes of the West Wing, you know, President Bartlett talks about this notion of civis Romanus. And that's always stuck in my head. And the idea of civis Romanus was that anybody that was a Roman citizen could travel the face of the earth. And by merely uttering, I am a Roman citizen, civis Romanus, they would travel unharmed. And I always equate that to cooks in this ego battle that I can go into a kitchen and, you know, hey, you know, I'm a cook down in Delaware, you know, can I lend a hand or can I hang out of the kitchen? And the next thing you know, you're working in the kitchen with somebody for a couple hours, you're sitting at the bar afterwards having a drink. You know, that's a good feeling. You know, you have that secret handshake, if you will, and, you know, you feel the callus on the underside of the index finger. You're like, that's what that's about. So, right? There it is. There it is. You know, I think that goes a long way. You know, I've gone into other kitchens where, you know, oh, get out. I don't want to talk to you. Okay, well, that's fine, dude, but you're really missing out. I mean, forget the online community, which in itself, you know, can it stoke the ego? Yeah, but you know, more often than not, it's humbling. You know, I want to learn more. And I think, you know, I know when I was 20 years old, I knew everything.
Oh, yeah.
But wait. When I was 25, no. That's when I knew everything. Wait. When I was 30, oh, I knew it all then. No, that's not how it works. You continually learn. And I think once you get past that hurdle, you know, the ego tends to, I don't want to say it's deflated, but it's more in check. And I think there's something to be said for humility and being humble. And when you go into restaurants where the chef is truly, truly dialed into his craft or her craft, it shows and you can taste it in the food. You know, food is supposed to make you feel good. You know, we're not necessarily talking about food as medicine or anything like that, but, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. Just take your foot off the gas. Be humble about what you do, exercise some care, talk to people, and really make some good food. And, you know, the ego gets in the way of that. You know, so that whole thing with the cape and the apron and all that, that needs to go away. Oh, that needs to go away.
Yeah, quickly. So another kind of hot topic is, of course, you know, when we talk about millennials, you know, or the Gen Y, you know, there always seems to be, you know, a lot of people have frustrations or challenges with them. What are a few ways that, you know, chefs today, modern chefs or leaders in kitchens and restaurants, what are some, a few ways they can help keep them engaged and also employed in your kitchen?
I'll tell you what, this, the employment market right now is pretty interesting. You know, in my current capacity, I get asked probably every day, you know, for some form of, you know, hey, I need a chef, I need a cook, I need a dishwasher, I need front of the house. And while I'm not necessarily, you know, I don't fancy myself as an employment agent, I like to help out. But I'll tell you, it's tough. You've got some very, let's call them shallow pools of labor right now that sometimes don't have quite enough chlorine in them. So a lot of the guys and gals that you're pulling into the kitchens or even front of the house don't really belong there, or they're overpriced or they're not qualified, but more importantly, they think they are. And I think that's an important distinction because I'll train anybody. You know, I love the 51-49% rule, and I, you know, Danny Meyer talks about it a lot in Setting the Table. I'm a huge fan. You know, the 49% being the skill and the talent, and the 51% being the personality. And I would rather hire somebody any day of the week, and I'm sure anybody would, that is just willing and able and energized and happy to, you know, kind of be alive at work, versus somebody that comes in, and this almost goes back to the ego, that's got this, you know, kind of this swagger that knows everything but can't work with people, can't keep a station clean, can't keep organized. I don't need that. So, you know, some of the things that, you know, I look at for the Gen Y hiring, you know, millennial hiring, I don't think is as much of a problem as it is just maybe a bit of a puzzle. And I think some of those puzzle pieces, you know, you got to be flexible with schedules, period. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to enough, you know, folks, you know, under the age of 25 that are going, you know what, I'm going to the Mumford & Sons concert, you know, Saturday night, whether you let me go or not. So if I quit, I quit. So either you schedule me off or I'm off. So either way, so that's a different approach. Now, are they dictating your work environment? Not necessarily, but you've got to be flexible. So I think flexible scheduling is huge. I think money goes so far, but I think stuff goes even further.
Yeah.
A gift card here and there.
Yeah.
build that into almost a compensation package. Hey, I was going to pay them $11 an hour. I'm going to pay them $10.50 an hour, but I'm going to make sure that, you know, once every other week, I drop a $20 gift card for gas or something, you know, into their paycheck. I think stuff goes a long way. You know, the little gold star, the little note pinned to your apron when you get sent home plays well with others. You know, I think that goes a long way.
Does not play well with others.
That would be safe for me. You know, we obviously we live, you know, these, you're talking about millennials as being digital natives. These are folks that have always been around, you know, Instagram, Facebook, MySpace, Snapchat. They need to have moments that are broadcastable. I think it's very important to keep this group happy by giving them opportunities to broadcast something, whether it's, you know, hey, my boss told me that I did a really great job on, you know, a table that had three difficult kids that were screaming, or, you know, the chef came over and told me that my knife skills were spot on. That's broadcastable. And I think that's hugely, hugely valuable. You know, and it can also help you out. You know, if you have an employee that's saying nice things, or several employees saying nice things about you as an employer or about your operation, that can help with future employment. Recruiting, and it also puts your business into positive light. So I think that's really important. I think it's also important to realize you need to expect to lose your staff.
Right.
That is just the nature of the beast. You know, the job for life thing has been gone for a really long time. That opportunity shuttered with steel mills. You know, you're going to lose staff. Just be prepared for, you know, there's a lot of statistics, you know, most often they say 100% per year, which may not be too far off depending on the segment you're in, but just expect to lose stuff. I think that's pretty very important. Some type of environmental tie. I think you're talking about a group of people that are very, very eco-conscious. Mm-hmm. I think if you have an operation that at bare minimum, you've got a recycling program that's effective. If you're recycling oil, repurposing plasticware, if you're using eco-friendly takeout containers, if you are partnered with a food bank, I love to do stuff for the Food Bank of Delaware. It might be sharing time. Your staff is participating at a soup kitchen. I think that tie to the environment and to the community is really important. You hear a lot from the Gen Y group that they want to be part of something that matters.
Yeah.
It might be 22 and they don't have a track record yet to be part of something that matters, but create those opportunities. You know, do one night a month at the a local Ronald McDonald House and do dinner. I think those pieces are really important. Hiring friends.
This
is a really social group, and there's nothing wrong with that. So you hire friends, whereas in the past they may have been kind of poo-pooed. I think it's important to allow them to kind of work with each other. You also get kind of a built-in labor pool. You got to be careful managing that because it can kind of, you know, the axe can swing both ways.
Right.
But hiring friends and then the friends and then phones. Phones aren't going away. And I see a lot of places that I go and visit and do some consulting work with, you know, no cell phones, leave your cell phone at home. That won't happen. Okay, it didn't work in schools, just like, you know, not using computers, and before that was not using calculators, and before that was not using ballpoint pens and whatever. Phones are part of our day-to-day.
Yes.
Let's find a way to manage it. Set a policy, but set a realistic policy. Yes, it's theft of time. If you're looking, you know, I love walking to a restaurant and the first person to greet you is lifting their head from a cell phone and then, like, kind of scurrying to throw it in their apron.
Right.
That's not a good policy.
No.
Set a policy, but realize that that's got to be flexible. I'm on my phone all the time. It's part of doing business. You figure it out, but you need to realize that that is, they're here to stay. And that put your head in the sand, but they're not going anywhere. So I think that's part of it. Food is another great piece. You know, friends, phones, and food. If only we can get phones to be spelled with an F. I think feeding your staff is really important.
Some people do spell it with an F.
it's the new language, right? I think food is really important. You know, we talked about kind of building the bridge between front of the house and back of the house. You know, make food part of that. If you feed your staff, you know, if it's a morning crew, make sure they're getting breakfast. You know, if it's, you know, a midday crew, make sure that maybe they're getting part breakfast and part of a lunch. You know, food is really important to this group of, you know, well, really to all of us, but food is really important to millennials. Right. they understand food. They understand flavors. It, you know, it used to be that family meal or shift meal was just like, come on. It used to be must go because it was must go out of the cooler. They don't go for that anymore. They want big flavors. They want things that they can be proud of, and going back to being broadcastable. Hey, look at our staff meal today. We got, you know, bao buns with, you know, Korean pulled pork barbecue. Wow, that's pretty cool. So food is really important. Keeping it fun, keeping your operation fun, I think is pretty big. And lots of praise, heaping praise, not empty praise, but heaping praise. Again, and it kind of ties into being broadcastable. That's really pretty important. I think there's a lot of pieces. Like I said, I don't think it's a problem as much as it's a puzzle. And there's a lot of pieces that kind of go into it. Some operations have it and some don't. Some operators really are good at dealing with the younger staff. And what you get from that is a solid labor pool in a time where labor is tough. You know, I think our state unemployment rate around here is like 4.3%. Wow. In the hospitality business, it's way less than that. Restaurant competition is fierce. Where there used to be one restaurant, there's now like 70. Yes. Give them a reason to leave and they're gone. You know, they're gone. So attracting that group and then holding on to them, really, really important. But there's definitely some solutions out there.
Right. Yeah. One of my big things I kind of preach is like, you know, like you said about opportunity, always give them something to learn, always give them opportunities to grow. You know, there's so many great books. We were talking earlier about, you know, books and stuff like that. Hand out books, hand out all kinds of stuff. There's all kinds of free trade magazines that we get access to, and hand those things out like candy, you know?
Agreed. Yeah. I think learning, you know, and that doesn't work for necessarily every employee, especially right. The younger folks, but, you will get one or two that will latch on to, you know, thanks for showing me that. You know, hey, can you show me how to make this, or can you show me how to make that? Now, they might tell you that they already know how to make it, but okay. But, you know, I think learning opportunities translate to, wow, my boss cares about me, and they cares enough to show me. I mean, we all know the old piece, you know, when the coach stops yelling at you, that means they've given up on you. So I think when the coach stops teaching you, that can be a sign too.
It's a sign also.
Constantly show an interest. You know, that breeds a little bit of civility within those folks that they want to do maybe a little bit better job for you.
Mm-hmm. So like out on the market and on the internet, you're really, really known for, you know, your food safety, because you're like a real big advocate of it. And, you know, we all know Chipotle suffered a kind of a major blow to their brand because they had some serious, you know, food safety issues. What are your five commandments for safety for the modern chef?
That's a good one. Yeah, they really, you know, I think food safety has always been one of those things that has kind of been in the background. We all know that, you know, safety does nothing but cost us money. As an operator, safety doesn't generate any money, but man, there's a dear price tag, and just there's like a big, you're talking about, you know, their fiscal recovery may not be till the end of fiscal 2018, and I've heard most units are down about 38% in sales. If you and I, you know, we're down 38%, making 62 cents on every dollar, there's a term for that, and that's, you know, out of business.
That's called bankruptcy.
You know, they're trying. I mean, they're definitely trying. They definitely went through some serious, serious issues. At the same time, they shined a light. So we've got to, you know, I don't want to say be thankful, but they definitely shined a light. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I kind of have like five notions that, you know, there's some great food safety training pieces out there, you know, whether very formal or not. I think you have to have at least some form of training program. But, you know, the five pieces that I try to instill in everybody, cleaning parties are a joke. You clean as you go.
Right.
Your operation should look as good today as it does the day before a cleaning party, the day after. I don't understand the notion of letting things get to such a point of disarray and disgustingness that you set aside, you know, some odd Sunday for everybody to come in and pull things apart. I don't understand that. I never really did. So what is the condition of the kitchen the day before a cleaning party? That's pretty gross. You clean as you go. You set responsibilities. Okay. That's the way it's done, period. Yeah. As an employer, as an operator, as an owner, you got to provide those resources. You know, if the three-bin sink doesn't have a drain plug or you don't have the right chemicals, that's another story. but you clean as you go. And that's not just a little cool motto you have hanging above the line. You do it properly. You break down your line properly. You break down everything to the mop sink, to the three-bin sink. You know, you should be able to eat out of a three-bin sink at the end of the day. And if you can't, you've got a problem. So that's my first one is, you know.
Yeah, and let me just chime in about clean as you go. So, you know, I told you, I apprenticed with my father, who was that typical old school yell, scream, raise hell. You know, his nickname was Wild Bill. And if you didn't keep your station clean, his punishment was this. He would make you chant out loud, clean as you go, clean as you go, clean as you go, clean as you go. And you would, I mean, he would literally make you chant that for, I mean, like an hour. It was crazy.
That's great.
Yeah. When I have nightmares, that's what I hear in my head.
But you do that now with millennials and they'll say, clean as I go out the door.
Clean as I leave.
Got to be careful with that one. You know, another one that I think is really valuable is know your vendors.
Oh, yeah.
Know your vendors. You know, too many times there's jobbers that will knock on your back door. You know, a true story, and I use this with food safety training, you know, participants all the time. I was working a catering operation. A lady came to the front door. Hey, I've got a great price on crabs. Okay. I have them right here in the back of my car.
Nice. I love
that. And I went out to her car, and I mean, I think she was probably living out of her car, probably fishing the crabs from the Delaware River. And if you're familiar with this area at all, on one side of the river is Salem Nuclear Power Plant, and on the other side is the Delaware City oil refinery. So I'm not exactly sure how wholesome these crabs are. I tried looking at them. Their three heads were all staring back at me on each one.
That's nice. That's nice. And they're glowing.
And they were glowing. I mean, this made Homer Simpson in Springfield jealous. But know your vendors. I know it's very, very popular right now. A lot of chefs, you know, I was watching Facebook this weekend. You know, a lot of the guys that, you know, that I know very well were out foraging. You know, morels are starting to pop up. Ramps are starting to pop up. We're going to be seeing fiddlehead fern soon. That's all well and good. But morels are out there, but there's also some other mushrooms that look like morels that if you eat them, things don't go so well. So I think it's really important that you're buying from, you know, reputable suppliers.
Yes.
You know, I love stopping at farm stands. I love, you know, I can't stand the beach, but when I drive down towards the beach, there's some great farm stands going through southern Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
That's all stuff that's wonderful and it's great and there's nothing wrong with those folks and I love to support them, but I just can't serve it in a restaurant because it's not an approved supplier. You know, knock on wood, you know, something happens, you're pretty liable. As a matter of fact, you're really liable. So my second piece is, you know your vendors. I think that's hugely important. Doesn't mean you don't support your local farmer. They just got to make sure that they're inspected and they go through all the proper paperwork, you know, depending on whatever state anybody's in. That stuff's really important. My third piece is chemicals. Every chemical has a job. Every job has a particular chemical. Only use chemicals when necessary.
Right.
I think we are really quick to slap some chemical onto, say, a flat top or a backsplash. And at the same time, you still have food sitting in a saute pan that just got a great dose of degreaser. chemical safety is something that I think we kind of take for granted.
Yes.
But at the same time, number one, chemicals are expensive. They can be very dangerous physically. And I just think that sometimes just a little bit of elbow grease goes a long way. You know, I can tear up the back of a range much better than any chemical can. I can just work it and get it to shine and save some money as well. I just think chemicals, when necessary, nothing wrong with them. Nothing wrong with them at all, but when necessary. So that's kind of my third thing. My fourth one kind of goes with the fifth one. You know, set expectations.
Yes.
Set expectations. Lead by example. You know, when you have an owner of a restaurant that plops through the kitchen and dips a finger into the soup to taste the soup, and then grabs a handful of French fries and then dips them in the ranch dressing, what have you just said? Exactly. What have you just said? And that's bad. That's really bad. So
silent approval by not saying something you just said it's okay.
Exactly right. So number four is you set expectations. You know, here's how I want this cleaned. Here's how I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. I'll do it. Now you do it. Now I'm going to correct you. And now you've got it. Good. Great. Let's go ahead and move forward. I worked for a catering company once. We had a master cleaning schedule. One guy cleaned the oven one week and he did a really lousy job. The following week was my job. Clean the oven. Oh, you did a great job. You can clean the oven all the time now. Like, so wait a second. I'm getting punished by doing this really lousy job because I did it right. You set expectations. So that's number four. Number five, be tough.
Oh, yeah.
In my world, I don't care if I'm a consumer, if I'm as a consultant, if I'm, you know, working with anybody. In my world, the last phone call I want is that there's some type of foodborne illness outbreak. You have to be tough. Food safety is non-negotiable. If I tell you not to have painted nails when you're working in the kitchen, you don't have painted nails. So if I tell you to put on a hat, but it's going to mess up my hair. I don't care. Then shave your head.
Yeah.
You wear a hat, you wear a hairnet. That's the law. And you're not going to mess with that because I'm the one that ultimately is going to pay the price. And I explained to everybody from every kitchen. I was just doing a kitchen training today. You know, when there's a foodborne illness outbreak, if you're in a small town, word spreads fast. If you're in a big town, word spreads fast. Ask Chipotle.
Yes.
You're unemployed. You could lose your restaurant. So you're tough about it. So you set a policy. It doesn't have to be an encyclopedia-sized collection of food safety rules, but at the same time, you're very tough about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I see bartenders scooping ice with a glass. I see it all the time. It's a pet peeve. You're fired. Like, that's it. Like, you are risking my entire livelihood if you scoop, you know, ice with a glass and a piece of that chips off. Best case scenario is you're going to notice it happens. And now the poor dishwasher is going to come out, burn the ice. And then you're going to get a piece of glass in his hand. Worst case scenario is you don't notice it. And somebody across the room gets it in their drink. That's a bad day. Your day just took a pretty bad left turn. So that's kind of my fifth one. You're tough. It's really non-negotiable. Provide the resources. You know, you need little green scrubbies and you need red buckets and green buckets and you've got to have an endless supply of side towels, you know. Oh, well, we only get two side towels per shift and they're kept in the safe. Okay. You know, provide the right tools necessary, but then be tough about it.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't really put a cost on that, you know, an extra towel here and there and stuff like that, you know, in the green scrubbies. So, so I'll tell you, like, one of my consulting nightmares. I was, this is back in the 90s. I was consulting up in Telluride, Colorado. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of guys up there, like, you know, a lot of guys like dreadlocks and, you know, live in tents, you know, it's Telluride, you know, come on, you know, a lot of patchouli going on, a lot of Grateful Dead music. It's kind of cool. But, you know, to this day, I can't stand the smell of patchouli, but that's a whole nother story. But anyway, so one day I've noticed that the guys just aren't, they're not cleaning their hands that well. So I wanted to get one of those little nail brushes, you know, the little scrubby nail brushes, right? So I bought two of them. I think there was like $10 for two of these little nail brushes. The owner, right in the middle of lunch, and this is like during like Bluegrass Festival in Telluride, when you're doing like, you know, 500, 600 covers for lunch, you know, in a small place. It's just, the machine only stops when it runs out of paper. And he, you know, he runs back on the line and he's like, he's a little bitty guy. And he's like, What is this? He's got his invoice in the hand. I'm like, what do you mean? What are you talking about? He goes, well, you spent $10 on nail brush. I go, yeah, these guys need to clean their nails, man. You know, they need to brush their hands and they need to get that dirt that's on the outside of their finger. They need to get that and clean that. He's like, $10. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe you're like freaking out about $10 for a nail brush, just two nail brushes. So I reach in my wallet. I give the guy a 20, go here, here's 20. And honestly, I never got change.
That's great.
Never got change.
You know, it's tough to get through to a lot of operators, but you know, food safety, it's only an expense. And that's a tough gig. That's a tough gig to sell. But it comes down to it's the only gig.
It's the only gig.
It doesn't matter. You know, I remember one time I was going to Florida. Night before my trip, I knew it was foodborne. I got sick as a dog. I was horrible. got to the airport, and it was right after a huge blizzard. Airport, you know, got there, airport, you know, we're closed. Turned around, came back. I couldn't have been more relieved, because I think getting on the airplane, and even I was going to Disney World, it just, and that stuck with me, because I thought, you know, this is probably something that was preventable, and somebody made me sick on the eve of my vacation. What if you were saving for years, and you were going on a cruise, or you're going overseas?
Right.
That sucks, you know, and you know, there are very few things that you put in somebody else's body. Food is very intimate, and you have to treat it with some dignity and some respect. And, you know, getting that through to folks, I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I don't understand the notion of working in a restaurant for 8, 10, 12 years and not understanding what temperature you cook chicken to or how to reheat leftovers. Like, you have to have a license before you can operate a motor vehicle. You have to have a license before you carry a gun so you don't hurt somebody. But yet you're putting something in somebody's body, and you can just go ahead and do it by filling out an application. And in some cases, you don't even need to do that.
Right.
So I just, you know, my nightmare scenario, and there's a couple of them in restaurants, you know, certainly somebody getting hurt, a fire, a robbery, but a foodborne illness outbreak, man, that's the end. It doesn't matter how good your menu is or how great of an operation. Hey, wow, it's a great restaurant. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
so. That's that soapbox.
No way, we could go on that for a while.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this question: if success was a recipe, what three ingredients would you say have to be in there?
Wow, three.
Three.
300.
300. Just three.
I think. Let's start with the obvious. I think, you know, I think skill is really important. I think. Skill is kind of an all-encompassing piece where you are on top of your game. Mm-hmm. You're paying attention to the industry. You know, the adage, you know, there's a couple of them, you know, the adage that, you know, either you grow or die.
Yeah.
I don't think it could be any more true for restaurants. And I don't understand why restaurant operators don't get that. You know, when you buy a computer, you buy because it has this size hard drive and this size processor. When you buy your next computer, you buy a faster processor and a bigger hard drive. Why would you not treat your restaurant the same way? You want to grow it. You want it to be appealing. So I think that's part of the skill of restaurant success, is really, really grabbing hold to this business. You know, and I stole this line from somewhere. You know, they say great writers borrow, or good writers borrow, great writers steal. And I stole this from somebody. But, you know,
you're honest.
You have to work on your business, not just in it.
Yes.
And it's so obvious. But, you know, it means going out to dinner. It means going out to lunch. Mm-hmm. It means sitting in your own dining room and watching what's going on. It means talking to your customers. It means scouring social media. It means traveling. It means all those pieces that all fall into the skill set of being a really good cook, chef, server, operator. And, I mean, yeah, you could say restaurant, but really any business. You know, you've got to be on top of your game. So I think skill is the first ingredient. Pride. I think pride is another big one.
Oh, yeah.
You treat your operation, you treat your job like a craft. Mm-hmm. I think that's so important. You know, a long time ago, somebody said, you know, I said something like, oh, I'm just a cook. And it was almost like I got slapped. They said, just? What do you mean just? Just a plumber? Just an electrician? What do you mean just? You buy stuff, you fix it up, you resell it. I stole that line too. That's what a cook does, but you're using what you know. So you should have some pride in what you do. And you know, that's really stuck to me. You can taste pride. You can taste anger. You can taste love. I think you can taste all those things in food. I think pride is something we forget about. Now, we talked early on about, like, you know, ego and cockiness, and I think those are two different things. I think pride is treating your job like a craft, and I think, you know, we are craftspeople, and I think that it doesn't mean you wear your apron turned around. It just means that you treat it like you've put some time into it, that you've read a book or two, that you've practiced, that you pick up a knife and you practice your, you know, I've been cooking since I was 15. I practice my knife skills every single day.
Yes.
You know, talk to a good golfer. They practice their golf swing. You talk to a baseball player. They practice their batting every single day. I take pride in it. You know, oftentimes I tell people I'm a cook, you know, oh, well, you're a chef at this place, or, you know, you're a chef for this big company. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'm a cook first. And that grounds me. And at the same time, it keeps me grounded to the fact that there's a craft involved, and it's an age old craft. As a matter of fact, people have always been eating. I like that. I kind of like that piece of skill, pride. And man, I think the one thing that we often overlook is energy.
Oh yeah.
Bring it. You know, you got to bring the energy. You get up in the morning on a day where you just don't feel like it. You find some form of inspiration, whether you meditate and find some clarity and balance, whether you go for that early morning walk. If you're Anthony Bourdain, you know, it's, you know, 18 cigarettes on your walk to the restaurant. you know, I think energy is so important. I think getting, you know, let's call energy the same as enthusiasm. I think that's a piece that we really, really often forget. Right. And again, that circles back to grow or die.
Yeah.
You know, on days you don't want to do it, remember why you're doing it. And again, if you are, I'm not using the passionate word. If you are proud of what you do, bring some energy, you know, take care of your person, you know, do some planks in the morning, do some reading, but bring the energy. I think that's so important.
All my clients get serious lessons in state management, managing your energy levels. You know, that's like biggest thing. And like a lot of times, you know, we talk about time management. And I always say, you don't manage time. You manage your attention and you manage your energy is what you manage.
I would agree with that. You know, I think one of the other lines I use, you know, kind of frequently with a lot of people that get stuck in the mire is, you know, what we have is an industry that it's hard work, mm-hmm. but it isn't hard.
Yeah.
There's a lot of work that goes into it, but it's not really hard. You know, Joe Bastianich, I'm a big fan of Restaurant Man. He did a great book with Mario Batali, and he said, you know, really all we're doing is just buying stuff, fixing it, and selling it for a profit. Mm-hmm. This isn't rocket science, you know. Right. Have a good location, have a good product, pay attention to it. You know, the variable is your energy. Put some freaking gusto into it, and I think that's really, really what matters. So that's kind of where I stand. You know, skill, pride, and energy, that it's been my, almost like my mantra for the last million years in this business. So it's what I do. It's how I kind of, you know, it's neat that you ask about the three ingredients. Those are my three. My three are skill, pride, and energy.
That's good ones. Those are good ones. Yeah, I'm a huge believer in energy. Energy to me is, I always tell everyone, energy is everything. You know?
Agreed. Yeah. Take vitamins. I don't know. Get more rest. Get less rest. I don't, whatever.
Take care of yourself. That's my big thing. Stop being a martyr, man. You know, take some care of yourself. Self-care is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and that, it's funny you say that because it circles all the way back to, you know, the apron turned around as like a mm-hmm. superhero. You know what? If you're working 23 hours a day, every day, that's kind of your own fault.
Yeah. You know, that's on you. I tell them all the time too. That's on you.
Yeah, that is on you. And you don't have to work, you know, 120 hour work week. Listen, there's times I'm up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I get done at midnight. Okay. That's not every day.
No.
You know, do you pull 14, 16, 20 day stretches? Yes. That's not all the time. It's not what's to be expected. You know, you're not doing anybody any favors. You work hard. Yes. But you also work smart. You know, you work harder and smarter, mm-hmm. you know, it's just part of it. If you're working sick, you're making other people sick. I don't care what you say. You're not supposed to work when you're sick, you know. And again, going back to the early days, unless you had like a sucking chest wound and like your arm was like taped on, you went to work. What good does that do anybody? You know, whatever. You know,
I can fix a sucking chest wound. I was a paramedic in the military. I can fix that.
Oh, good.
What? Sucking chest wound? I got that. Flail chest? I got that. Don't worry.
I mean, listen, we've all done it. You know, you nip your fingertip. I'm not saying you wimp out. Yeah. You put a little super glue on your finger.
You can see it
later. Mm-hmm. But, you know.
I'm missing that corner.
I got one too.
Yeah, cut that sucker off when I was 16. You know how you know they're teaching you to do the claw, right? And my dad's like, you know, you're gonna. I had my fingers out straight. I'm like, I got this. And my dad's like, you're gonna cut something off. I'm like, yeah, you know the smart ass 16-year-old kid. You know, I know what I'm doing.
Oh sure.
So, you know.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey, wow! Look, it has its own heartbeat.
Yeah.
Wow.
That hurt a lot more than I thought it would.
Yeah. Yeah. We've all been there. And you know what? After a while, you stop doing that. Like, at some point, you have to get better. You have to have all your fingers and you have to get better.
Yeah. And never, don't hire a line cook named Stubby.
Yeah.
That's my tip for tonight, for hiring tip for tonight. Don't hire a guy named Stubby.
Exactly.
So you got any upcoming projects that going on? I know you mentioned earlier before we went on, before we went live, you're talking about you had a website in development.
I have had a website in development for a couple of years. Something that's very, very near and dear. I think like most people, everybody's got a story to tell, and I want to tell some of those stories. I want to tell stories of cooks. I want to talk about, you know, I don't want to say their inspiration or their passion because that's a cop-out. I want to just talk about the stories. You know, why are they doing what they're doing? And maybe because they couldn't find anything else. You know, everybody can be a starring role in a kitchen if you want enough. So I'm going to tell the true kind of gritty stories of cooks near and far. So the next piece for me is the website that's going to go live hopefully in the next couple weeks. It's been a couple years in development. I've always been one of those people that's been very impatient. You know, here, quick, do it now. Okay, great. Didn't think it through. This one I have actually thought through. The business cards and the stickers are printed, so I'm well on my way. Got a fabulous web developer that's done a really great job.
I want some stickers.
I don't know what's going to happen with this site. You know, if nothing else, you know, they say writing is a way to keep you from going insane, so I'll be even more sane. So that's the next piece. I do a lot of writing for Foodable, and I'm out there doing some spots for poach jobs and toast on occasion and some local stuff. So I continue to do that. I love the social media circus, if you will. I'm a big fan of Twitter. I was a really early adopter with Twitter. To this day, I still think it's a lot of fun. It's where I get my news. Big fan of Instagram. So I continue to kind of spread the mojo that way. I think there's a lot of great bonding and camaraderie that goes with those pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, LinkedIn and Facebook and all that fun stuff. I like that stuff. But yeah, the next big one is the website. You know, working on the merch. You know, you got to have the merch before you have the site because that's just so important. So that's what's next.
So you mentioned I know you're not going to the NRA show this year, but you're going to one of the shows up in New York, right?
Yeah, the Fancy Food Show up in New York at the Javits Center. I think it's last week or so of June. Great show. Like seeing the trend stuff. Big fan of seeing what's coming down the pipe. You know, the NRA show, listen, it's great. It's a great show. Obviously, it's huge. It's also a lot of steps. Very, very big. The Javits show, a little bit more FaceTime. Little bit more time to kind of manhandle some product and talk to folks. You know, you can normally cover it in a day and a half. You know, whereas the NRA show, you know, you can normally cover it in a month and a half.
Yeah, it takes at least 3 days, I think.
Yeah, that's a pretty serious show. And, you know, if you need a hotel, you've got to basically stay, like, in Yuma. You're not going to get anywhere near Chicago with that.
I booked my hotel room out, like, 2 months ago.
Yeah, and even then you got lucky.
Well, I was lucky. I travel a lot, you know, for my work. And so I'm a Hilton Honors member. So I had lots of points that I cashed in.
So. Not anymore.
No, I don't have any points anymore. They're all gone now. They're all going to the hotel room in Chicago for the NRA show. So
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Well, I want to say, you know, thanks again, Chef Jim, for taking time tonight. It's always great to have passionate people on the show talking about things. And I'll have links to anyone interested in contacting Chef Jim on especially, you know, how to up your culinary game, food safety, and definitely we'll be looking out for your future website. So in closing, to me, being a chef has always been an honor and a privilege, and you have to look at it like that. It is an honor and a privilege to break bread at a table and to share your art and creation with another human being. Someone once asked me, you know, what I define as being a chef, and my answer was this: as a chef, I elevate the human experience through a culinary medium. And probably one of the greatest quotes I ever heard from a chef was when I worked for Wolfgang Puck, and his right-hand man, Lee Hefter, was asked by a reporter kind of for a statement about his food. And his reply was simply this: I make my statement on the plate. Boom. All right. And with that, you know, if you're looking for more tools to take your restaurant to the next level, please go by and check out the Restaurant Coach University. There's online courses there to help you build your brand, strengthen your team, and increase your profits. All you need to do is take action and go over and sign up for the VIP list. It's free, by the way. All great stuff over there at www.restaurantcoachuniversity.com. Again, thank you so much, Chef Jim Berman, for joining us tonight. Anything you want to say before we go?
Thanks so much. I look forward to getting that site out there and chatting some more.
Awesome. Everyone have a fantastic evening and be safe out there, especially with food safety.
Thanks for listening to the Restaurant Coach Podcast with Donald Burns. Tune in next time as we serve up more ways to maximize your potential. Visit our website at www.donaldburns.net or download episodes at iTunes and Stitcher Radio.